Welcome to Playing Conversations. On this episode, we talk with Thomas Belhassin, whose career so far has spanned automotive and product design, performance footwear design and innovation, creative direction, and brand strategy. Hope you enjoy our conversation.
Oh yeah, no, I remember them. I lived there for a minute, so it was my favorite time of the year for sure. The other 6 months, not so much. When the rain kicked in every day, I was just like, oh man. That's why the nature is so great over there. I guess yeah. It comes with it, you know? It comes with the rain, so.
Where are you based now?
LA. A little bit sunny, less green, but yeah, a little bit more sun. So.
No, I'm originally from LA area too, so.
Oh, nice. Where are you from originally?
Thousand Oaks. So not too far north from Los Angeles.
Cool. Yeah, yeah. I'm around Echo Park right now.
Oh, cool. I lived over there briefly when I went to Art Center.
It's nice. It's quiet.
It was cool. I was there during like peak hipsterville when just like lots of deep V's and I don't know, people with their Terry Richardson mustaches looking all like Jeffrey Dahmer fashion style, which was really bizarre.
It's only gotten more gentrified, we'll say, throughout the years, especially the whole area. So yeah, unfortunately, even the past 10 years since we like lived there, it's been insane how much the city has changed.
It's crazy. Even when I go back, I'm always like, man, I don't recognize this place anymore. Sometimes better, sometimes I wouldn't say worse, but it's just kind of different.
Yeah. There's no good or bad in LA. There's no better or worse in LA. It just is what it is, you know?
Yeah.
It's always going to be like this fluctuation of weirdness, I guess, in this kind of place, just because there's so many different types of people. It's going to keep growing and changing, but it's definitely getting unlivable, like in terms of like living costs and stuff. It's kind of ridiculous.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think the thing I miss the most about living out there, definitely not the cost of living, the cultural centers are so good in LA. That's one thing Portland lacks. There's art museums and stuff and kind of little subcultures that people kind of create their own communities. But more of like the institutional, well-funded cultural centers like the LACMA, even like the Peterson's amazing. I really miss having accessibility to, you know, that quality of experiences.
Yeah. And I guess that's funded by all these wealthy people that just don't live in Portland. You know, that's the issue. It's like LA is just funded by the people that live there for different tax benefits or whatever you may say, or image placement and stuff. But yeah, they spend a lot of money and that's why these museums happen. But yeah, I think Portland has definitely like a lot of different, what I loved about it is that everywhere around the city, there's small different little cultural centers, you know, whether you're northeast or southeast or like wherever you go, there's little like pockets of stuff. Just a little different than LA, I guess. The pockets are quite vast and quite different. You can go to Koreatown like 5 minutes from here and the culture, obviously the culture shift is like so different from where you were in like Echo Park. Like you said, like the people with the mustaches and stuff and then you go somewhere else, like it's totally different. So it shifts quite dramatically. Yeah. Anyways, what's up, y'all?
Well, have you guys met before?
No.
No, no. You haven't? Because I like, you know, you maybe both knew of each other.
Yeah.
Thomas, do you remember when we first met?
Oh man, so long ago.
So
that was at least like what, 15, at least 15 years ago, right?
Yeah.
At least. Okay.
Yeah. It was like my first walkthrough at Art Center. Like I took a trip down there. My mom was with me. We walked into the student store and Thomas was working there. And he like walked right up. He was so nice to me. He started telling me everything about what to expect. And like you were on your way. You had just gotten accepted, I think. And it was like your last little bit working there. So like we go that far back. He was like one of my first, you know, students that engaged with me while looking at potentially applying and going there. It was nuts.
That was my first job out of high school. Yeah.
No way.
When I moved to Pasadena, I wanted to go to Art Center. So I was just like, oh, I'm going to go study in Pasadena and just go to community college. And I needed a job. And so I dropped my job at Toys R Us. I was like a manager at Toys R Us in high school.
No shit.
And they relocated me to the Pasadena area and stuff when I moved there for school. And I ended up dropping that job and just finding a job at Art Center. Somebody from Art Center introduced me to the manager and she needed a cashier. And I was like, yeah, I'll work there. And then I met, that was like the best end. For 2 years, I worked there before like getting into Art Center. And I met everybody, all the people that worked in every office, all the teachers. I got free demos from students all the time. I met people like you. Like, yeah, it was the best time of my life. I enjoyed that job so much.
Yeah, dude.
It was just like a little art store, but I met so many cool people.
That's crazy.
That's actually probably a pretty good way to get into that school because there's so many different avenues that all of those majors take. And getting an understanding of like, you know, what people are doing and kind of where you want to go in that space. I bet that was super helpful.
It was super interesting because like you could see every term, like that store was really like the only store on campus at the time. So pretty much everybody went there as soon as they got their sheet curriculum with like what they needed to buy. And every time people came in and showed me their curriculum, I was like, oh, you're in film. And I could like learn what film was doing kind of. I was like, oh, they need all this stuff on first term. Like I'm kind of understanding what these majors were doing. It became actually really insightful, like long term. Like I didn't realize like process is so driven by the tools and the things that you need to get the job done. Like understanding those tools, like really early on, I was like, super interesting. And then obviously the people I met was like the best part. But
yeah, it always felt like you already had the ear of instructors. And as like you went through the program, like they were already kind of like helping move you along. And you had already built like those deep relationships with them over the years, which is so smart.
With some of them, for sure. And I was just so curious, dude. I was like, oh, if you can give me a print of your curriculum, like, I just want to see what the class is about. Did you have prints for demos? And like, I was just like trying to hoard a bunch of stuff. Resource hoarding over here. Yeah. But I think, that builds your resource library and it just allows you to build your visual library eventually. Yeah.
Crazy.
Definitely weird job. But yeah, dude, meeting you there like 15 years or so ago.
That's crazy.
And then dude, you had a different, you wanted to do products and then you love cars and it was just like you bounced back and forth. You ended up, you did the craziest path too through our tenor. So
yeah, we've always been, you know, I always felt like in transportation, there's the people who straddle entertainment design and transportation. And then there was like the people who straddle product. And you and I are definitely a product, but you also have a good entertainment kind of twist on your stuff every once in a while. Like you could go farther away than I could. I was always kind of stuck in product principles, which pissed off a lot of teachers.
No, but that made your work super clean. Yeah. It did. Yeah. But it kept things like fresh. I feel like everybody was so sculpture heavy. Your stuff was very product and like very like function focused. And when the style and the aesthetics came together, it like gave something super different, which obviously worked really well for you. Yeah. So.
Thanks, dude.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah. Matt, what, you studied graphic design there?
Yeah, I studied graphic design there, yeah.
One of the best majors at Art Center. And like every grad show, that's the room I spend the most time in, for sure. Graphic design.
Yeah, it was always the one that's the most crowded just because I feel like graphics was one of those things that just could go in so many different directions. And there was a lot of really talented people, especially in the class that I was in. It was insane. And what was cool about that department too is that everybody was super collaborative, which is awesome. Nobody was, you know, gatekeeping anything. Everybody wanted to share and have feedback. Like we go and work at each other's houses and stuff to kind of get real-time feedback and super supportive. And I still talk to a ton of those people today.
That's awesome. What was your focus in graphic design? Were you focused on brand at the time already or?
It was a mix. Yeah. So brand was one of them. I did packaging for a little bit. Which was great. I think kind of like learning the architectural sense of design and a lot of the tools and materials was really, really helpful. I find myself finding ways to apply those into my workflow and work life still. But I kind of switched at one point. I was like, am I just making like beautiful trash? And then also packaging designers just follow guidelines. Like a lot of them, like the packaging agencies, they get brand guidelines and then they just basically create a sculpture that, or, you know, a package that does its job, right? And the life cycle can be, depending on what it is, it's like, if it's something really premium, it can be really long, but for the most part, it's pretty short. So yeah, I kind of dropped packaging a little bit and then went more heavy into brand, because brand is one of those things where brand can be digital, brand can be packaging, brand could be environmental. And I like the sense of not creating such a narrow view of what design was, like seeing the potential of what it can be.
For sure. I shared that passion. The more and more I step out of just doing product and like very kind of more detailed industrial design, I realized I'm like, I like to zoom out, and brand is obviously the most like the biggest umbrella, right? Encapsulates pretty much everything you do for any type of business. So super interesting.
Working with Matt, I think that packaging, like having a lot of your focus being packaging and a thing that comes into like a 3D, a form factor, I've found that Matt is like, as a, you know, graphics kind of first person, he has a spatial reasoning that is really, really fun to like bounce off of. So when we did like that trade show, it's just like that understanding of proportion in the real world is like, he's got it locked, and it's never a thing we have to discuss. He's just like, he knows how to bring things into the right, you know, execution in 3D. It's so cool to work across from that.
I never thought about that, about how packaging design is like 3D graphic design.
Yeah.
And if you get good at that, yeah, you can definitely be good with space and different, because you're just designing an experience that you have to go around anyways, right? So, that's super cool.
Jason pumping my tires.
Yeah,
thanks,
dude.
Look at that.
Well, and I think it comes back when we like look at stuff digitally, we're in the same way, like the way we would assess a body side and like bone lines and proportions of like the greenhouse, like that's the way he and I also talk when we like look at, you know, a layout of something for social media. We're trying to check the proportions and the balance of everything, and it feels like it started from the 3D world in Matt's brain and it comes back to the 2D, but it's really cool. It's a bit of really fun kind of working relationship in that way.
I think it's an interesting skill set you touch on, even as like UI UX designers, instead of being able to think dimensionally and not just like at their experiences, but like at systems, at different things. Like, I feel like we map out things for 2D and so sometimes like strictly visually 2D that things end up even in our thinking being 2D in a way.
Yeah.
So what you're talking about here is like, even like if you're thinking about pixels, thinking three dimensionally of how things come together is a pretty fascinating like way of looking at some 2D problem solving. Very cool. I'm going to apply that for sure.
Nowadays with how diverse the market is and diverse market needs, it's everything has to be viewed from the 10,000 foot view. It's how all that stuff comes together. How does your UI experience relate to like an unboxing experience, right? It's all theater, right? And telling a story, creating the connections between all that stuff is really challenging. But when you pull it off, man, it really hits pretty heavy.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And it lives beyond the product, you know? That's the main thing. The product is a point in time where the brand is hopefully continuation throughout time. So hopefully that experience that you're creating, the 10,000 foot experience is definitely what's going to stay longest, you know? And that's why I don't think they teach us to focus on in design school, at least not in our majors. We focus so much on the product and the final execution of that one object that we like forgot to zoom out. Like, why does it exist? And how can it be very different? And all these things, we're just like, nope. Surfacing.
Yeah.
There's something good about that though. I mean, I found a lot of those projects, the things that are actually really important within the industry is, you know, what problem is this product solving and consumer research and all that stuff. In art school, that is more theoretical than it is based in reality. And I definitely found that myself and then, you know, other people I was around were post-rationalizing their decisions to make it fit some kind of narrative. So it was a complete package upon delivery. But a lot of, you know, art school is more about that skill set development. And, you know, all of the real world stuff really comes in through like the internships and later in life.
100%.
I always got in fights on that because I had almost an undergrad degree in product design before I ended up going to Art Center and like basically starting over. So every time it got to that point of like trying to create like a fictional buyer for your concept, I was trying to like create actual business propositions. And it was, they're always just like getting too heavy into like, oh, you have to do your persona and justify like a very narrow view of what you're solving. And I never really enjoyed that. And I always got in trouble for that. But I think it's partially, yeah, it's that skill set development versus, you know, understanding how to do real world applications in a business that needs to be driven by real decisions, real insights.
I mean, they're trying to feed industries and that's understandable. You know, like we're literally industrial designers. Like, I mean, for us and even graphic design exists because of the industry. So like, yeah, they're trying to feed us into jobs that we can just do right away out of school. So the hard skill sets are what we learn, but it's really interesting. There's not much room for both. So like, there's like a lot of European schools are way more into theory and like all this stuff. And then when it comes down to application, it's all just like very thin, paper thin, we'll say. So they go into the industry and then learn the hard way. Whereas Art Center already, like, I feel like places like Art Center at least drill it into your head that it's like, this is the industry. This is what you need to know to like get in there and then you'll learn whatever you want to learn. But yeah, it's like you said, Matt, I like that you touched on internships and even that before jobs, because I think that's like one of the biggest growing curves is like you'll see students at Art Center come back after an internship and they're just beasts. Like all of a sudden, like it took 6 months and they're just a different designer. And you're like, what the hell happens on an internship? You know?
Yeah.
it's like learning on steroids or something. And so you like, once you get the taste of your first internship, you can't go back. This is when you're like, okay, this is where the real learning really like starts kicking in. This is when things like fit together. And this is
And internships are so great too, because when you're going to school, you're super hungry. you're a bit naive and you go into an internship, which in most cases is kind of like a safe space to really mess up. The excuse is that you're an intern and you're learning, you're not an employee, which is great because it's pretty forgiving and you get all of that real experience. So by the time you go back and you go into the real world, you know all the things that are right and wrong to do in the workplace because you've already made a lot of your mistakes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Low risk, high reward. Because especially if your work gets picked as an intern and like things like that. Like, so, like you said, you're not risking much by being there and just like experimenting and testing stuff. But it's also high reward because that's how a lot of jobs get landed. You know,
yeah.
You do good at your internship. Good pipeline into your future. So, yeah.
Matt, what internships did you?
I did one in San Francisco for Smart Design, which is an industrial design firm. And then I also did, I worked for a small independent bicycle manufacturer doing graphics and communication and like nice. Brand building stuff for them called Franco. I don't know if they're still around, but yeah, it was super fun.
And then you landed Patagonia straight out, right?
Yeah, Patagonia was like right after I graduated.
Crazy.
No biggie.
Yeah.
No biggie. How was that?
Such a sick job. I loved it. It was my dream job. And it was cool because it was like, you know, I grew up in Thousand Oaks. Patagonia is based in Ventura, which is only like 30 minutes away. Yeah, it was so much fun. I just remember I was there for 3 years. And I just remember on my last day, I was just like crying in front of all of my my coworkers because I was so sad because I didn't want to leave. But it was one of those things where I knew that I had to leave to move on and to develop into a career.
Yeah. It's hard when it's like, it is, you know, Patagonia is it's a dream job for most people. Most designers would kill to work there. So yeah. When you get that first thing and you have like a great run there, it's gotta be weird to, you know, pick up and decide to put yourself in a new position. Right.
Yeah. And it's crazy. I mean, a lot of people stay there for a long time. For them to hire somebody like me on, when they did, I was seen as being like super young. And I think I was 25 or 26. And it was a really interesting experience because you had people that were there for so many years because, you know, the lifestyle and people just kind of lock in, for better or for worse.
If you could pinpoint it to a couple of things that really made you like take that next step, like leaving your dream job, right? Like it's a big risk. And I think we have all done it. Like all of us have had various career shifts, I would say, quite dramatic sometimes. And like, what do you think are the reasons that really like gave you the courage to just be like, okay, I'm going to leave my dream job and just like take the next big step, you know?
It was one of those things where I saw the work that I was doing and it was really exciting and fun. I had an amazing boss who from my first day gave me a ton of opportunity, something I probably wouldn't have gotten anywhere else. But I didn't see myself developing. I actually felt at one point I kind of started regressing as a designer. Because, you know, graphic design is not the priority at Patagonia. It's a product driven company and all the stories and communication is from that. Or I shouldn't say it's only a product driven company. They're very like environmentalism and sustainability is definitely above all, you know, really
their messaging and the marketing is really on point. Like they push that really hard and that's a big core part of their business for sure. But
totally.
I see how limiting it can be because they've created an environment that's so Patagonia. You have to kind of live within that. And when you live within that with those key messages they're trying to say, I feel like things could potentially get repetitive and you're an echo chamber of a lot of messaging and potentially, I don't know, exploration.
Yeah, I was there during a pretty interesting time though. I was there when they were going through their first really big brand overhaul.
Wow.
Like picking new typefaces and redesigning the Patagonia.com.
Nice.
Kind of refining the messaging and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I was one of the first people that was hired on in kind of like that big wave of transition. I just needed to go to evolve and I knew that. And I needed to, you know, my wife and I, we both grew up in Southern California, went to school in Southern California, and we had an opportunity to leave to go do something different. We wanted to take advantage of that time and that opportunity. So that's one of the reasons why I left, because I saw more interesting things going on. You know, in Portland, we looked at Seattle at one point, which is kind of funny because we moved and then like 3 years later, LA then started to become like this graphic design epicenter, right? You know, everybody was getting out of New York and going to LA and it was just kind of like, man, I missed the boat by a few years, but moving up here is definitely got a lot more experience and a lot more opportunities.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say, maybe that was a lucky timing because maybe it would have been a madhouse down in LA with all the all the graphic designers coming down.
You'd have been already embedded and not given the same, you know, maybe not the same amount of flexibility and opportunity.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
Potentially.
I mean, that's that was, for me, it was like, that's what brought me to Adidas as well, was like, you know, Tesla was the dream. I got to work at Samsung and then Boeing. And that was just like saying yes to a couple opportunities that, you know, mentors threw in my path. But like Tesla, looking back, like, was there ever going to be another time to get a brief on your desk that looks like that?
Yeah.
You have Model 3. I found myself just like realizing I don't know anything about materials or manufacturing or like finishes. And, you know, I had buddies like Jacques that were up in Portland, and I was like, you know, either specialized or Adidas were like at a really kind of interesting time where I could learn some new manufacturing technique, and came to Portland, which is where I'm, you know, from this area, but got to travel all over the world for like 3 years, which was, I don't think it would have been possible anywhere else. And that time at Adidas was like this new heyday of like sending designers out for inspiration, man. Mm. Got exposed to so much stuff. And at the same time you were over, you graduated right after me, and you went up to Nike, right?
Yeah. About the same time, I think. Yeah. So yeah, 2016 or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I moved up to Portland. That was interesting, especially after living in LA for so long and traveling a lot too and doing all these internships. I was just like, okay, ready to like go live in a place for 5 years, and or at least for like a certain amount of time, you know, because I saw Nike as like this like long-term kind of dream job, honestly. And switching out of car design was a little tough. It was like I had to pick either car design or product design. But I think when I saw what Nike could offer in terms of like a young designer and the learning abilities, like you're talking about like manufacturing and materials and all that stuff, that's like one facet of what you learn at Nike. And then the spectrum of what you have to learn as like an innovation and like a footwear designer in that industry is pretty wild. And I think the well-roundedness of all the skill set that I would be able to learn is what really drew me to that job. I was like, ooh, I can do all these things. That sounds so fun.
It took me like a solid year to be like, okay, I get what's going on here. Like there's so much to learn about how they, you know, set up size grading, and like the amount of components that get made for a production, you know, program is kind of nuts what they pull the trigger
1 year
on.
Is fast, man. What, because like every I've been in it for like years now, and every year I'm like, oh shit, there's still more to learn.
Yeah,
like because it's crazy. And that's when like in forward, at least in forward design, like people don't realize the amount of people it takes to make a shoe, between designers, engineers, developers, material costing engineers, and like this is like 50 people making one shoe.
Yeah.
And that's not even counting the people at the factory that are like, so like as a designer, if you manage to like learn a bunch of these facets, like just like being in meetings with people and what they're talking about, like putting the pieces together of what actually makes a product. And then when marketing gets involved and brand gets involved, I mean, Matt, you're involved in brand at Adidas. So like, I'm sure you have to tell some product stories and stuff, but like being able to learn how the marketing team does that too, and how they deliver the message to the consumer. That's when like things really started clicking for me. Like I got exposed to all this stuff at Nike, like finished the product, and the marketing team comes and was like, so what's the story? And I'm like, what do you mean? I've been designing this product for 2 years. Like, please tell the story. And then they're like, we're going to create a whole new story. And you're like, ah, oh, great. So like seeing that spectrum is what like really drew me to just go into footwear and just innovation in the product space. Cause I think I was just like, ooh, I feel like learning all this stuff becomes really beneficial if you want to create your own thing or.
Yeah.
Yeah, just being more well-rounded in general.
I always found like the development part of the shoe, like the actual development part when you're going and getting samples and all that stuff, that is just so labor intensive. It's, you know, you're going international a ton because that's typically where the main manufacturing is. Considering materials, especially for like, I see football cleats behind you. It's like, what's the flexibility of, you know, the harder parts on that? What's the wear and tear on it? How does it mix well? How does it glue well to the upper and all that kind of stuff? It just, it's an amazingly technical product once you get down to the details.
And it's surprisingly complicated. I just don't think people realize how hard it is to make a shoe, for sure. You know, talking about automation and things like that, for example, like shoes, like people have tried to automate shoe manufacturing, but they can't because of how complex everything is, you know, especially soccer cleats. Right? You're talking about material and just there's so many doors and so much depth to each layer of making a shoe. I mean, and I'm sure it's similar for a car. Obviously, it's like, you know, engineers have to like solve every single little problem, like HVAC and heating and all this stuff, like everything in the car. But I feel like a lot of it is carryover, and it's been pretty much, you know, like this for years, and shoes manufacturing evolves all the time. Materials evolve all the time. Like, I don't know. It's kind of an interesting space where it's also hard form for me, like coming from a car background, it's like, especially soccer shoes, hard form molded parts with really soft, soft like product on top. So it's like learning how to work both together also gave me like a lot of flexibility in like applying my skill set. It was really, really an interesting experience for sure.
Yeah.
Doing shoes is kind of, the development process is definitely the most fascinating part. Going to factories and seeing how they make stuff and like understanding why a shoe can be a certain way, or
yeah,
it gets very technical.
The pitch when I joined Adidas was like to be on some of those automation programs. So like Adidas like took some good swings at it with like Speed Factory. But what I think always fell apart was, yes, you can solve the technical side of putting together like a system of shoes that you put together and, you know, bake in things like direct to fabric printing so you can tell some kind of regional or city focused story. But eventually you can't bake in the amount of storytelling value to the customer on a system like that you could in individual product development that seasonally rolls out. So they did a lot of really cool technical stuff, but I saw, you know, rethinking how you put shoes together. But in the long run, it didn't really shift the business model. And it's really, really, really difficult to do when compared to what already exists.
Yeah. Right? Scaling innovations like this is really, really tough. And I know it comes down to money and manufacturing, all that stuff. Like designers and engineers, especially in footwear, are obsessed with creating this next innovation. But most of these innovations depend on machinery or materials innovation. Like it's mostly those two things. And sadly, when it becomes a manufacturing thing, then you're talking about millions of dollars of investment to get those machinery just to make that one type of product. Then you have to figure out, can we actually make a bunch of product and a whole lineup of products that can like amortize the price of these machines over time? Because like Flyknit, for example, was like Nike's like almost biggest investment outside of these buildings they build, you know, like buying all these Flyknit machines was super expensive. They had to find a way to make Flyknit work for all their sports. It couldn't just be a one bed pony. Like, no, it had to be everywhere across the whole company, marketing, everything. Like you had to breathe like Sonor. Like it was Flyknit. Adidas did the same thing with a bunch of their products, and it works out of certain products, but some of them you just can't. Like, yeah. And it becomes really tricky when you get these like really great innovations that are just not scalable because it's so expensive. You know?
Yeah.
And you realize that the kids that you show these products to sometimes don't really care either.
Yeah.
That's the sad part as a designer, is like you spend all this time like creating this cool new thing, and then kids see it. And for them, a lot of time, like we call this style innovation. Style innovation is innovation. Like they would see something like a new colorway, a new material shift, a new finish, a new, like just that for them was innovation. Whoa, that's new. Like that's innovation for them. Like it didn't have to be like, oh, we spend like hundreds of millions of dollars like buying these new machines. Like they couldn't even tell that was Flyknit. They couldn't even tell that was a knit product. They were just like, wow, that's the finish on it. And you're like, cool.
One of my favorite examples of that is on a shelf behind you that I've used with a lot of young designers about like how to think differently is the camouflage, like pulling that from an automotive reference. You wanted to tell Matt about that one a little bit of what those shoes typically looked like on athletes while they were testing.
I mean, yeah, basically when you design a soccer shoe, they have to go on professional athletes to be tested. And those are usually very watched by paparazzis and like sneaker leaks and stuff. So they're just black shoes usually that you paint black, or they're just black out of the factory for the players to test. But black shows all the form. Like you paint something black, you can still zoom in. You can see pretty much everything. So people were always like, oh, that's the next shoe, blah, blah, blah. And for Tiempo, for this shoe, like leather shoe, We kind of developed this new technology on the leather where we could like do these finishes on it. And we're like, dude, instead of making another black boot that we're going to sell limited edition, blah, blah, for the launch, I was like, dude, let's make like a cool camo inspired by car camouflage. Like back what we used to do in cars is literally like, yeah, you put a crazy dazzle pattern, military dazzle pattern, and then you just like plaster it all over. And since we found a way to print on leather, we were like, dude, let's just do it all over. We dipped the bottom of the shoe. So everything 360 is like really impossible to read. And those shoes went viral. Like people like saw them on, because we put them on professional players and stuff, and people play with them. All the paparazzi were like, what are these shoes? They couldn't tell. You could barely see a swoosh. You couldn't see what it was. And people were like, what is it? And because for that product specifically, we had no marketing budget at Nike. It was an off season. They were spending all their money on Mercurial, which is their biggest product. Makes sense. Tiempo had zero marketing budget. So we basically made free buzz, brought a bunch of like interest to the shoe that we made an edition, limited edition of it. We made only like 800 of them. It was Tiempo 8. We made 800 of them, and we ended up actually making those commercial for people, and they sold out in like an hour.
Oh, that's super cool.
Free marketing buzz. And I just pitched it to my PM.
Change the business.
I showed them a print of the design, and I was like, can we do this? And my PM, honestly, I got to give credit to my PM because he's the one that pushed it all the way up leadership. But I just showed him an idea. I was like, can we make this? He was like, yeah, let's make it. We made it at the factory. And once we had the product, we went and pitched it, and people were like, okay, we're in. And then marketing opened up budget all of a sudden. And we're like, okay, cool. And all of a sudden, like, yeah, we had access to a little bit of budget to make that thing grow up. Because without that marketing budget, like some products can die, you know, they live on terrible like shelf space in stores. They don't have any marketing or digital or like backup and stuff. As good as the product can be, like if people don't see it, people won't buy it.
It's crazy how with some of the bigger brands, I never worked at Nike, but I worked at Adidas for several years. Seeing how scalability totally can kill a really amazing technology. Adidas had a really cool technology that basically made it met your height, your running style, whatever, all these requirements, and that they were going to produce a custom piece of equipment for you on the spot that was like perfectly catered towards, you know, what you do and who you are.
Yeah.
Ultimately, it ended up being a very watered down version of it. It's still inline product now, but it's interesting because you see a lot of smaller brands now that are doing things that are very similar. And since they are not, you know, scalability isn't as massive for them, they're doing a lot more interesting things. So it's like a lot of the smaller brands are kind of becoming a bit more of the innovative brands right now.
Yeah,
I agree. Yeah, on just did like a spray on shoe and like all the stuff, like it's still small innovation. I don't think that's going to scale, but you're right. The accessibility to like all these new brands and what they're providing to the market, it's super fascinating because it's making the big guys really scared. I mean, Adidas, I worked there too for a bit and they were scared of all the small players coming out. Nike is definitely scared of all the small players coming out. And the small players are not so small. When you look at their backing now, it's kind of crazy. Like we're talking about like hundreds of millions of dollars of investment to these companies. They're acting like tech companies versus like product companies now. And it's kind of interesting. Like Nike and Adidas operates like, you know, traditional product companies. And these companies are like built from the ground up within the last 10 years, like On and Ahoka, and like I'm Ahoka a little bit longer, but like, yeah, they're built fresh and with access to a lot of capital. And it makes you do some crazy stuff really quickly. Kind of interesting when you don't have like, sometimes the history helps you, sometimes it holds you back. So
yeah. Even from like an apparel perspective too, for, I guess running is like the best example. The smaller independent brands, like they legit make better product than some of the big players do. I know because I've worn all the product from the big players, you know, smaller brands like Tracksmith, who's, you know, very premium, very focused brand. Their running shorts are by far the best. They're the most comfortable. They're the best fabric fit style. They don't look too tech. You know, they look more kind of like old school collegiate, just an overall better product. And then like, you know, 10,000 is another brand that makes like workout and equipment stuff that is just on a whole other level because they don't have to meet this big, massive fit every person style consumer. Like they just go really focused and make one product really, really, really good. And it's cool, just, you know, because they don't have the overhead of like a, you know, big brand.
Yeah.
Yeah. It gives them room to disrupt the industry. And then the big guys usually steal from the small guys and make their product updated. They look a lot like the small guys. But no, I love, especially running is a great example of like, especially this like almost community-driven design work that's been happening in these like tiny subcultures. Like obviously run clubs have been coming huge and all the running brands that have come out of this run club movement or like cycling, like Rafa and stuff. Like seeing all these small brands coming out of true like small grassroots cultures and people designing for their function, you know, and then you say like they make the best products. It's like, yeah, they designed it for them and for those people that really want it. Whereas Nike, you're right, is designing for the hundreds of millions of people and not for the small community stuff. So yeah, I feel like a good like the big companies are going to be stuck in big processes and big new AI driven initiatives, all this stuff where things are going to become a little bit more dull. And I feel like these small brands that come out of grassroots activities are probably going to create the most authentic products. They're going to make like the stuff that people really kind of relate to, that are more artisan-like, that have more, I don't know, more craft, more story.
Speedland is like one of my favorites that I've been watching over the past few years, like a couple of art center grads that founded it, who worked across like all the different footwear companies in Portland. It's like rare to find designers that can
out of Portland
like,
too, right?
Like you who have been able to go Nike and Adidas or Under Armour and like fit into all those communities. So those guys, like the authenticity of the storytelling that's like in their designs, in the tooling, they have like the names of the Portland trails that you can run, like built in to the midsoles, and the way that they're constantly out at every one of these like ultra marathon races. It's just been really cool to see. And I've listened to like a lot of the How I Built This podcast, and like Innovate was one of those ones where I was like, damn, like what a cool story where one of the first shoes, they get it overnight to one of the runners and they win, you know, this crazy ultra marathon race in Wales or wherever it was. And Speedland is like, I think, one of those stories. So it's been really cool to watch. I feel like they fly under the radar for most people because they're so niche, but they're slowly expanding.
Yeah.
I think kind of their story, which is nice because it's coming from an authentic place.
they're so niche, but like you said, they're becoming super well known within that niche. Like they're winning races a lot. They're doing some, I mean, I feel like some of the stuff is a little old school, but I think a lot of the stuff really fits well at what they're trying to do in their community right now. And so I think it's like you said, for them to expand eventually, it's a great place to start, like starting with that, those people that really need it and that know it.
Yeah.
And they can do it. Like their experiences together collectively, they can do some crazy stuff. So yeah, excited to see what they do, what their future product lineup will look like, or how they even expand the brand. Because I feel like it needs to look beyond the product, as we talked about. So now they're really deeply embedded in the culture. So how do you like really make a brand that reflects that?
Start meeting them at different touch points with the same level of thinking and consideration. Yeah.
So I saw you posted something recently on Instagram, or you're working on some kind of like vintage rally inspired brand or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of community driven thing. Yeah. So I've had a little break in my project, clan projects this year. And for a couple of years now, me and my brothers have been talking about starting a little project together. So growing up, me and my family race rally. So mostly my dad and my mom, and then my brothers.
Oh, that is so rad.
So like old production classic cars that they used to basically strip down, put roll cages in bucket seats and just trap themselves and go race. So that was kind of like my weekends and my childhood. And my dad, my stepdad, my mom, my two brothers, myself, it was just a whole family thing. And I don't know, I've always found that space fascinating. Rally is like one of the, I think, probably the coolest motorsports that exists. I think people like Formula One because it's so mainstream and so easy to watch. But I think like rally has probably the most access and the most accessibility and the most like financial tap in that you can do in any motorsport. So there's something that attracts me there. And I think it lacks a lot of like interesting stories. It's got such a crazy history, and there's not really any brand or any kind of like, there's a lot of different culture points, I guess, around rally, but there isn't too many people that are trying to tell those stories in a way that comes through in products that people can like experience. I'm trying to figure out a way with my brothers. So my little brother races rally quite often, like pretty much every weekend. So he's like a perfect person for us to be on the ground, like actually living that life. And he's like noticing all these things, and he's just bringing all this stuff back. And then this year I had a little bit of a break in my client list. And I have 2 months to pull something out. So we decided to create our first collection, create a company around it, and do a whole thing. And yeah, we're launching June 1st.
What's it called?
Surviage. French name, meaning oversteer.
That's cool.
Kind of the idea of like everything needs to be kind of pushed to the limit. Our tagline is live flat out. You're kind of on the limit all the time. And rally is one of these things, once you get strapped into a bucket seat once and then one of those cars, you're like, what the hell is going on? Like it's a really like life-changing experience. It like warps your brain in a weird way. And my brother is strapped to those seats like every weekend. I'm like, how do you do it, dude? So I'm trying to figure out, how do we get that like that crazy edge and that crazy passion, the crazy history that comes with this sport? And how do we start telling like stories around there? How do we tell narratives? So we grew up with a car called the Alpine A110, which won the first World Rally Championship in 1973. And my stepdad owns one of those from like way back in the day. And we decided to create the first capsule collection around that car. It won the first World Championship. It made sense for us to honor it. We grew up with that car. There's pictures of us as kids in that car. Like, there's so much like history that goes there. So there's going to be some apparel. There's going to be some art coming out. There's a bunch of like different things that I'm just slowly leaking with like a movie I'm making around us and the car. So we'll be driving into some French stages, rally stages in south of France this summer, doing like kind of like a short film. I'm trying to like just create content around it. I'm really trying to just bring life to that car again. Like Alpine is a huge brand now, but they haven't really been good at telling a story of like what they've actually came from, like all their history and racing and stuff. So I kind of want to tap into that for that first collection. And then eventually just tell a bunch more, like just naturally try to grow this thing slowly, just seeing where it goes, see how we can capture community. We're doing our launch on June 1st is actually, we're also gathering, doing a huge car gathering in south of France. So there's going to be like over 100 classic cars with rally cars mixed in the mix. There's going to be a bunch of like about 100 cars, and we'll have like a stand with our brand and like the Alpine in front of it with our collection and a bunch of stuff. So it should be pretty sweet. We're just taking it small right now. We're starting slow in south of France, like with attitude a little bit. Taking it easy. I'm just trying to learn, basically putting together all the things I've learned over the years about brand and like product, little things like that. I'm just trying to see in 2-3 months what I can put together with my brothers and just see what we can push out.
That's so cool. Old school rally has such a cool, like 80s and 90s rallies is just such a, even 70s too. Like there's so much cool design and innovation within that. People don't really realize like Audi basically built their entire brand off of, you know, just dominating in rally and getting people introduced to, you know, the Quattro and all that kind of stuff.
It's a marketing driven sport, just like most motorsports at that level. Yeah. But it also drove, like you said, insane amount of innovation. And you mentioned like decades, like if you look at Raleigh in each decade, it's a clear vision into technology and culture and like all this stuff, whether it's like liveries, whether you're looking at how cars are made, when they introduce carbon and Kevlar, like if you look at how they evolve, it's step by step with Formula One at like pushing like motorsports. Like Group B, obviously in the 60s, were already making like the most insane machines we've ever seen. Yeah, four-wheel drive was the first example of like being used in a freaking family sedan. It just hasn't been well documented, especially in digital age, and mostly because WRC, the entity, is gatekeeping a lot of this stuff. I think F1, when they got bought by Liberty Media, they made Drive to Survive and just like exploded the brand in so many levels and just allowed people to come in. And I think WRC and Rally is at that time. They're the fourth biggest motorsport, fourth most watched, fourth most followed after like NASCAR and MotoGP and Formula One. They're the one that have the most potential to blow up. Once the gate gets open, like once somebody buys them or an investment firm gets interested and they open up the rights like media and all that stuff, because WRC, you have to basically go WRC.com and pay for that. And you have to just watch it that way. And the small little clips they give them on YouTube and the tiny things they do on Instagram, there's nothing. If you're a fan, you can't follow. And when you go to rallies, fans are everywhere. Like anybody and everybody is there watching. Like there's just crazy. I'm waiting for the time. I feel like slowly growing a brand in the sport that I think is going to slowly blow up, because I think that's just smart. A matter of time before they're going to open the media gatekeeping. And I think people are going to want to be interested in like all this stuff, because if people are interested in Formula One for the glitz and glamour of it, people will be interested in Rally for like the dirt and grit and like grassroots level of like interest that there is to it.
Yeah.
And it's worldwide. It's in every country. It's in everybody's backyard, literally. People just go and like go to the side of a road and see a crazy rally car drive by. And it's like, it's a really weird experience. You don't have to pay a lot of money to go see a rally car.
If you get that like Drive to Survive level of, you know, the content capture where it's no longer YouTube video of the same corner of the like cars doing something and one of them rolls over, you know, like that's not engaging people in the stories that drive that sport.
If I could fund a Drive to Survive around WRC, I would, dude. Like, and I'm surprised. Yeah. I'm sure somebody is working on it somewhere. And that's also what I'm a little bit on this brand. I feel like it's a matter of time before somebody, a production house or somebody with decent guys will do a year of following WRC.
Yeah.
It's one of the craziest like experience to follow like people around in Kenya and like all these places driving these cars around. And it's super well documented. They have helicopters following them around. The content is insane. I think it's the sport of the people more than any other sport in motorsport, because it's not on the track. It's not behind closed doors. And I think the fact that they're gatekeeping the content, I feel like goes against the sport. So I feel like it's a matter of time before that opens up. And once that opens up, it's going to open up a huge culture shift in the sport.
Yeah, I mean, Drive to Survive, basically Formula One going to that kind of level of accessibility and doing that, being able to watch Formula One on ESPN in the four races was, you know, something that really helped that sport. That's kind of like the talk with a lot of people right now. It's like Supercross, motocross industry. They think that sport would totally blow up too if they created more accessibility. It like created wider viewership through creating those behind the scene moments.
Yeah.
It's worked for, I mean, they did it on Netflix. Look, they did it for golf. They did it for
tennis.
They did it for the Tour de France. They did it for a bunch of stuff, and it helped those sports. Viewership blew up in tennis. It blew up in a lot of these sports. It's probably very expensive to do sports like motorsports, like WRC and stuff. It's probably cheaper to do tennis and like golf when things are more stable and you don't have to chase vehicles around and stuff. But I have a feeling with some simple reasoning, it's a cash grab for anybody that makes that type of thing. It's a cash grab for the WRC. It's a cash grab for whoever produces that type of content. So I'm sure it's going to happen at some point. I just want to be set up authentically as a brand that like really understand the space and do like fun things and products that we care about mostly. That's what I care about. And the sport, I want the sport to survive. The sport is slowly dying. It's really hard to make rallies happen in tiny villages around Europe and around the world. You know, like the coordination it takes to create a race like that is insane. And so like the sport dies slowly and slowly. More life, more brands, more things around that world will hopefully get the knowledge out and get people to know about it and get people to fall in love with it. I feel like that's how you make things survive, right? You pass a message on and and you tell the stories of the past, I guess, and some of the future. We'll see. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of people doing a lot of cool edits around like the past and stuff you just see on social media now.
Yeah.
Especially obviously Group B, like so many people just totally romanticize about that era in Rally and just all the cool cars that came from that, you know, like the Lancia Stratos, the Lancia Delta Integrale, like just the super cool things. And even like the Subaru era, like the late 90s era of Rally and how big that is with like the 555 car and then
Colin McRae and like, you know how much it took out of me to not do a Group B collection at first. I was like, oh man.
It's such an easy thing to go to. I
was like, that's why I didn't do it. I was like, no, I can't do it. Hold yourself back, keep it for later. I was like, I gotta build up to Group B. I gotta be ready
for the Group B. Yeah.
But the STI and Evo era of rallying is so cool too, right? Super raw still, like the cars, you know, they're still so close to what a production vehicle is.
Yeah, it made people dream. They were like, dude, the Subarus and those Mitsubishis flew off the lots. People were just like, I want that car.
Oh, yeah.
That's so they were cool. Yeah, it's like the biggest marketing moves for them. Like they sold so many cars just going to rally and just throwing those cars around, showing what they could do. That's the best product lesson. It's like, hey, put your money where your mouth is. It's like you're saying all these cars can do all these things. Like, yeah, if you win the World Rally Championship, then like legit. I believe in that car, you know? It's like, yeah, I can't wait. I can't wait until the time I can do like rivalry collections where I do the Subaru vs. Mitsubishi collection. And like,
oh, that'd be so cool. Because they're so feel, different yeah. looking too. Like the rally art look versus the STI look is
the
so...
The blue and the red is like the good versus the evil. Dude, there's so much good stuff. And that's what I love about... Like everything was really like thought through in rally. Like they knew Mitsubishi is like bright red, Subaru is blue. It's like the true big one. Like there's so much like interesting thought throughout all this stuff. I'm hoping to be able to build more narratives around. We'll see how time goes. Maybe you're not, but we'll see. I think it'd be fun. And there's a lot of art going to each collection. So with the Alpine one, we're doing like old French comic style, full comic strip with the storyline and stuff. And I'm printing some parts of it. So that like every collection needs to make some art. So I'm kind of curious how it's going to look on some future collections, especially some of the stories we're trying to tell.
Can't wait to see it.
Yeah, man. June 1st, we'll see. Slowly, I'm building up on Instagram, slowly but surely. It's going to take time. I'm building everything myself, so.
That's nice. You see a lot of people now within our industry going to their second version of college or their master's degree, which is like working at these big brands and using those as learning opportunities, then taking all of that knowledge, then applying it to something that they own and they love. So it's really cool when you see people do that and, you know, do things that are really interesting, like bring different intersections of like sportswear and automotive and all that kind of stuff. I guess that was probably pretty natural for you because you've studied in the automotive space. And I think Jason mentioned that you did an internship with Bugatti or something.
Yeah.
Was that correct?
Yeah. I feel like this was just the time to put some things together, just a few things together that I've had on my mind. And I think I wouldn't say culmination of everything, but slowly like the pieces, because I did a brand startup and I interned and did some contract with Bugatti. And then I did all these different things and I never understood. I always thought like, oh man, I jump around a lot. Like I never specialized in anything, but I realized like my specialty, I think, is like creating narratives and just finding a funnel through what product it could be. You know, I feel like the product is the end point. It's just the end messaging in a way. It could take a bunch of forms. Right now, it's taking form of just simple console with prints, you know, just because I can't do much more than that. But financially, I'm held back. But eventually, I want this to be full experiences. I want to throw on full rally events. I want to like deck out a whole rally car and build a rally team and like pay for my brother's seat to go to WRC. And like I've got dreams to build this beyond just making clothes and product. Like my goal is to like, hopefully a full experience. And so I'm just trying to see like, what else could it be eventually? Yeah, my car design background hopefully will come into play. I hope in this project at some point, it'd be fun. Although that car design side of me is like a whole part of my actual full-time job is I designed that. And so I just keep that for that for now. And then eventually those skill set will come in and match up at this rally brand. So
I think one theme that we've kind of experienced on a few of these podcasts now is just people that have like a really strong sense of just curiosity. And wanting to see where they could take it, or like you're saying, like being into so many things and different kinds of experiences and ways that you're applying the things that you learned. And I always feel like that is the best way to go about life in a design career. It's really not creating limits for yourself, not getting into one funnel of like, this is the only thing that I do. This is all about my identity. Like learning how to use multiple different forms of technology and media to expand, you know, the art and communication you want to create is just, it's so valuable.
Yeah, I agree. Especially if you have a little bit of entrepreneurial spirit, I guess. Yeah. If you have that itch a little bit of potentially like want to build your own narratives and your own stories, I think being able to tap into a lot of these, like, even if you only know 10% of marketing and only know 10% of merchandising, I feel like knowing these like small 10% adds up to way more than just knowing 100% of doing a product. And so,
yeah.
that's what it takes to get something started, because then I can hire eventually and delegate like those specialty roles that I can't do myself 100%, right? Then I can hire a really great graphic designer, which is what I did for my Rally brand, because I'm not the best graphic designer. So I hired somebody that was really good at it, and I'm not the best illustration artist. So I hired somebody to do that. And I found that like being able to create this thing with other people and like not having to be myself 100% responsible for everything is just like, it's kind of nice. It allows me to do 300% worth of work instead of just myself trying to do everything at 100%, you know? So it's been fun knowing all these like little things that I've learned over the years that are just coming together to just build something.
Yeah, it's right, awesome, man. When you get to work with really like talented people and be in that kind of like art direction, creative direction role, and you know, really make somebody else's skill set shine to tell that bigger story in a really high quality way.
Yeah, because my goal right now is just to orchestrate a bunch of stuff to come together for launching, right? So like, I can't be doing everything myself either. The visual part is like what I think comes naturally. I think as you create the strategy and as you start diving deep into what you want to build, I think the visual identity and the visual stuff kind of builds itself. That's why I'm a huge fan of like Figma and softwares like this, where you can just throw a bunch of crap on a board and zoom out and see what kind of like fits together in the clusters that start building. And like, if they could make a 4D Figma, like we're talking about thinking three-dimensionally out of our systems, yeah. I think if they can start making a three-dimensional Figma, or can start building some crazy like connections between things, I think it'd be pretty wild. But for now, yeah, being able to zoom out and just putting these pieces together has been probably the most fun part of that process. Yeah.
Yeah. To do something that's like you're passionate about that comes across as being, you know, really authentic, or I guess when you're passionate about something, you know, you're coming from a really authentic place, right? Of the deep love for, you know, rally racing and wanting to push that forward. So it always creates better content that way, rather than having somebody behind a desk with media ambitions that they only want to just give viewership, and it's just kind of a watered down formulaic thing, you know?
For sure. And for this one, I also try to tap in a lot into my brothers and like our small rally community that we have around my family, just to like get people's opinion and feedback, just to make sure I wasn't like, because it's easy for me to be like, wow, I have all the experience in designing things and I'm going to say everything is... I there's some stuff I just had no idea. I was like, I need feedback. Like I created 20 versions of something. I'm like, I don't know what's good at this point. It's like, it just is what it is. So like, how do you know if it's authentic if you don't show it to those people? So I just shared it with them. And then my brothers and the people around us gave us a bunch of good feedback. They were like, oh, what about this and this and this? And then when things come together, it felt more like a collage of ideas than like more of like of me putting a direction out there. And just like, it kind of came naturally throughout the process. And I think that feels good. I feel like we just pulled the trigger when the time was done to produce stuff, and that was it. Like I could have worked on the art for another like 6 months, obviously, but just the fact that we wanted to be done for an event, just need to produce something, like made us like just make something. And it is what it is. It's not the best, it's not the worst, it is what it is. And then eventually we'll grow on that and build on that and see what happens.
Yeah, totally. It's kind of, I mean, that's such a great way to work too, right? It's like you're vulnerable in your process, you're showing it to people to get a reaction, you're responding to that, you know. It's like even like when we work with clients, you know, we don't want to just be like, cool, hey, we're going to go off and do our own thing and we'll let you know when we need you. It's a process of communication and being like, hey, getting them comfortable with the idea of knowing like this is not finished, like, or this idea is very in process, and getting a response to that to see then where you can push it has always been super helpful. And there's no surprises. Like everybody can anticipate what it is. And then it, like you're saying, it like goes back to being in that authentic space.
And you need that feedback. You need authentic feedback, because people are not 100% of people are going to love everything. Not 100% of people are going to hate everything, you know, like, and especially clients, they're going to love some stuff. They're going to hate some stuff. And that's like the part of the designer job of like shedding the ego a little bit. It's like, oh, obviously some things are always going to be good. Some people are going to like it. Some people are going to hate it. And then, so I'm trying to set the expectation for myself and my brothers too. I'm like, you know, some people probably will not like this and some people may like this. So we'll see. That's just what happens, you know, but we'll get that feedback and then we'll see what people want. And then
that's like one of the things as we're maturing as designers is like the hardest thing is to know when to step back and like elevate other people's work and like call in somebody rather than think you can take that on. And you know, that energy you spend there is, it's not going to be spent somewhere else that's just as critical. And you know, as you mature and you work across these different industries, you see all the pieces that need to be held up at the same level. And some, you know, the times where great design can, you know, set the stage for marketing where it's easy. You've kind of given them the stories to tell. But there's other times where you got to build those both up at the same level to,
for sure.
Especially, I feel like branding is, it's funny that we both kind of ended up in that space. Planco for me has been like, you know, the pandemic led to the opportunity to like either, I was interviewing at Specialized and then I had an opportunity to go full time here. And I was like, man, like I could build a brand. and it has gotten to evolve, which is the coolest part. But, you know, that was through diving into branding, which I was super uncomfortable, but understood kind of the world of how to do that. And we got a couple projects under our belt that attracted Matt here. And then Matt drove like this new vision of what we look like, the way we live digitally in the world. And it's allowing us to like dive into content creation at the way that I think will serve our brand properly. We're looking at our projects differently. It's starting to feed into client work. It's just really fun. So it's, yeah, I think it's great to be at this level and have people around that crush at their job and like are wanting to explore too.
Yeah, it's amazing what you can do with people that are, yeah. I mean, like you said, you had just a basic understanding of what it takes to put brands together. But when Matt comes in, it's like a different catalyst, you know, like all of a sudden. And that's when I think we've been all in the industry long enough to have seen some heavy hitters in pretty much all these positions that you know what you're personally shit at. Like I know what I'm really bad at. And I know that I need to have be surrounded by the people that can like complement those skills. Like I said, some graphic design and branding stuff is now my skill set, but I understand like the parameters that it takes to potentially create something that works. It's just, you can't execute everything. Like there's no way that we can be good at executing everything in the creative fields. There's just too many things to do. Yeah. But that's when hiring heavy hitters, I can just come and like really, having a good story, a good idea and all that stuff is great, but with that good visual execution, it's nothing and it falls apart. And like the work that you guys have done recently, like the wheels and the UTVs and then all the trucks and stuff, like incredible. Like the execution, the final execution of products like this is hard to make exciting and it's hard to make like really like powerful. And you guys did a really good job, honestly.
Thanks, man.
So it's tough.
Appreciate that.
It's tough. So yeah, well done.
Thanks. Yeah, I think like, I don't remember who said it, but the idea of like letting go of your ego is, man, that is like, that is such a gift when you get to that point, when you just hold on to things and think that, no, this is the way it should be done. Or you kind of obsess over like, no, this is my idea. I need to control it. It's like, man, being at a point in a career to where you can just be like, hey, I can call up Jason or whoever and just be like, what do you think of this? And then, you know, sometimes people will be a bit like diplomatic and nice about it. It's like, dude, just tell me if it sucks. Like, just like, let's get
this serving what we're trying to solve here. Yeah. Is usually the biggest question. Yeah.
And it's great. I mean, it's especially, you know, with all of us, a lot of people work remote now. You kind of literally work in a cave at points, you know, without outside kind of feedback. It's good to get that. Cause I remember when I was working freelance and just working directly with clients, I would labor over something that was a small thing, but it'd be like, you know, I'd waste 2 days laboring over something.
Yeah.
And then you speak with them and you're like, oh, I wish I would have known that piece of feedback 2 days ago, you know? So that's the nice part about working with a studio now. Like yesterday I called Jason. I was like, I'm thinking about changing like this brand color. And then we got into this 20-minute discussion about the brand colors and all this stuff for the power sports brand we're working with. Ultimately, it hit up to a much better result.
Yeah.
Hey.
Yeah.
If there's one thing we've learned in design school is critique, make better things.
Yeah,
you know, like,
dude.
And that's a life lesson. I feel like design life, mirroring, whatever. Like if you have a good council of people, whether that's your friends or like professional designers that can give you critical feedback on whether your life or your design work, obviously it drives you to be better, especially if you can accept that feedback. And I think that's part of shedding the ego. It's like, hey, listen, we're designers, we're artists. There's a million solutions to any problem. Any brief that comes through my desk from a PM is going to have a million endpoint solution. And we're just like, one supposedly person trying to siphon like an answer out of a million possibilities. Yeah, not everything's gonna be perfect. Some shit is gonna suck. Some things gonna be great. And because there's a million other people involved and 100 million other steps in the process and manufacturing, all this stuff, the end result is never a pure product of yourself as a designer anyways. You're just like 1% of that equation of what it takes to create that product. The product could have failed because a million other reasons, not just design. And so when you manage to like just be okay with that and every single product you're going to create, I realize that like, yeah, as long as you do your job diligently and you know that like you're doing the right steps, you're proud of that. The ego can like step away when you realize that like at the end of the day, it's not your product. It's not, it is what it is.
Yeah. I mean, and when people pull off at big brands, when people pull off like really innovative new things and there's a complete like product to brand story, you know, especially at like a big brand like Nike or Adidas, I don't think people realize how hard that is because that is going through so many layers of people, designers, and all that kind of stuff. And you're having to meet so many needs of individuals who in some cases don't see anything else but their individual need. And it makes it really difficult. So yeah, when people can pull stuff like off like that, hats off to them, because man, that is not an easy task.
Yeah. That's complicated for sure. And that's just half the battle. Cause then when the product is done, then people like you, Matt, and brand and marketing have to come and like make that product like digestible and that story digestible, because engineers and designers are very good at complicating everything and making things like super like detailed oriented. And then you have to zoom out and be like, okay, what does the consumer care about? And how do we like actually simply and beautifully say this message? And I think Nike has been masters at it with Whitey and Kennedy, and like being able to sell product without selling product is like the biggest marketing move ever. And it's the hardest. Like they never show you product on their ads almost, and they still make you want to just go to their store and buy shit. Like that's hard. That's brand. That's hardcore brand right there. And that's just like the day we can get there is the day like, yeah, things are going well. A lot of lessons learned from how to like even reverse engineering product design to just like think about how people are going to consume the experience. You're putting us a lot of time sometimes in things that if you zoom out and you think about the end result and who's going to consume it, you're like, maybe they're not going to pay attention to this. That should be a stress off my desk, you know, like just move on. What's the hardest you think in brand, like to tell messages from products that have you had products that you had to like work around where you're not really confident in the actual product itself? Both of you, I guess.
No, I mean, there, you kind of get really focused in on telling like whatever story that you've worked with, you know, marketer or writer to develop and put out there. And now, especially like, you know, not working at a big brand and working specifically with like a product designer and having product brand story come up at the same time, we've been lucky to where we're developing both of those in parallel. It's really true to it. It makes it a lot easier and makes the storytelling a lot more clear. And in many cases, we're telling the clients, hey, you're not defining this enough for a consumer to understand your product.
Yeah.
You need to be clear about this. You need to get past this point of this is a secret proprietary thing and figure out what can you tell somebody about this, because consumers want to know what they're buying into. You can't just tell them something is cool. What's the difference? What's the problem it's solving?
That's smart. Because a lot of people come to agencies or like sometimes product design agencies for like, oh, just a product, just solve the problem, just design that thing. And you're like, okay, let's go back to the beginning and let's go back to this process. Like, who are we designing for? What's that market like? Like, where do you just go through it and then you realize, okay, there's a bigger opportunity to pitch brand placement at this point. Because if you're doing research and all this stuff, then technically you're building a business plan, even as a designer. If you're looking correctly in the right place, if you're doing research on the market, if you're doing research on everything, like you're basically kind of building a business plan. And I feel like you can pitch those bigger point of views and those biggest like mental shifts in companies aside from product is brand. And if you can pitch those into the package, like it's so powerful.
Totally. I think like a better way to answer your question about like if I've ever experienced kind of developing a story for I don't believe in, it's not as much that as much as it is seeing brands go really aggressively after reactionary in the moment short-term gains. And usually that comes from a CEO who wants to show the company being profitable and that they're in it with the trends. And then, you know, they go super heavy into that. And then 1 or 2 years later, it just falls flat on its face. And
like Nike saying, we're going to go full digital. And that's what happens.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to speak in any specifics because I don't want to get in trouble, but
that's all good.
I'm going to be diplomatic on this one, even though I said I can be very direct, but it's odd, right? Because it doesn't go to really good brand building, right? It looks like a cash grab. And yeah, I guarantee you, like brands have had success with it, right? But you're building a fair weather consumer, somebody that's going to come in, experience your brand in the moment. And then once they try to get more into your brand or they just ignore it, they're just gone. You got them for that one time purchase rather than reoccurring.
Just temporary customers, it's just loyal customers. And that's the hard part to build, right? Like Nike had loyal customers for a long time. And I feel like sometimes some moves make you lose those. But also that's because smaller competitors are paying attention to the smaller brand. And it's easier than ever to make your own shoe as hard as it is. It's easier than ever to produce your own shoe and manufacture your own products now. So it leaves the door open for anybody with a little bit of money that's like paying attention to disrupt things. And so that's what we're here for, right?
Again, footwear, it's such a complicated market because it's not just like the things that could go wrong internally. It's, you know, all these competitors swirling around you trying to tell a better story. It's really easy for me to think back to like a couple of the innovation work streams where I'm like, this thing's dead before it starts. And like, okay, I'll continue to push this one. But then my product design, you know, energy and effort on that thing is not, you know, trying to push the brand story of that innovation kind of work stream that needs to hold its own in the environment. I'm not giving it the effort because it doesn't deserve it. But the ones we know, the ones that, you know, come from an authentic place and somehow get picked up later, they somehow find their way to the market, and marketing has a story ready to tell because the concept was driven by somebody with some really pure intentions or a really pure concept. And then there's ones where they orchestrate, you know, an innovation is carried through the brand of that, and the marketing effort and the design all kind of come together and go through the system. You know, the ones that make the most kind of financial impact and brand impact.
For sure. So, definitely.
Yeah. Well, I think we should probably end this so I don't have to edit too much.
Sweet. Thank you all.
Yeah, this was really fun, dude.
Yeah, super interesting.
This is great. You guys hold a good podcast over here. This is awesome.
Thanks, dude.
It's been really fun.
We'll be looking for you slowly doling the stuff out on Instagram.
Yeah, slowly, we'll see. I'm gonna go at my own pace. This is the beauty of this. This is part of the life lesson. I'm doing it for me and my family and my brothers. I'm just having a blast, and we'll see where it goes, man. Hopefully the passion takes over at this point. But yeah,
totally. Yeah. I mean, fuck it, man. Like, take the opportunities that you have in the time that you have to just do cool stuff.
Exactly.
Because it'll pay off. Whether it's just a, you know, has a finite life cycle, there's still, you know, the fact of doing it and putting it together is just so rad.
Yeah. And doing it with my brothers is like a thing that we've been wanting to do for a long time. And we're just like, I'm seeing a lot of passion out of them, and they're learning a lot from my world. I'm learning a lot from their world. It's like really interesting to see already kind of getting their hands dirty and just involved in this. And who knows where it takes us? You know, I'm trying to make them dream. I'm like, damn, guys, we could have our own rally car. We could like do a bunch of stuff. It's like, come on, let's dream big.
Yeah. Write those things down. They'll come true, man.
Yeah, we're going to move small, but we dream big, you know, and just see where it goes.
Yeah, know where you want to go. Yeah. Killer.
Cheers, Jess. Thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure. Matt, really good getting to know you better. And once I'm up in Portland, we'll all get a beer together for sure.
Yeah, definitely, man. Yeah, likewise. Yeah.
Sounds good. Have a good one. Awesome. Have a good rest of the week.
See ya.
See you guys.
See you, dude.
Bye.
Bye.